What time is it, you wonder? Well, it's time for Drinks with Tony on KPCR LP Santa Cruz 101.9 FM.
Ba-ba-da-ba-ba-boom.
Tony Duchesne here. Welcome to episode 124 of Drinks with Tony and my guest Harold Hayes Jr. He is one half of the writing team of Rucker Moses, and they wrote the book Kingston and the Magicians Lost and Found. I just finished teaching my monthly free writing class at the Los Angeles Public Library, which I love to death, but it just always wipes me out. Probably because I use all of my jokes for the last 90 minutes during the lecture and exercises. Who knows? Maybe it's better not to be hilarious at the front end of an episode. Hey, if you'd like to join us next month, keep March 10th open on your calendar, as we will start at 6 p.m. Pacific time via Zoom, and the library should have a link for us in a couple of weeks.
Hi, I'm Harold Hayes Jr. I'm one half of Rucker Moses, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Rucker Moses. He's the author of Kingston and the Magicians Lost and Found. Now, Rucker Moses is a pen name for two fellas, Craig S. Phillips and Harold Hayes Jr. I have Harold Hayes Jr. with us today. Harold, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Tony. Nice to meet you.
Now, I said Rucker Moses and he. So is that correct? Is Rucker Moses a dude in your mind, or is that a...
Yes.
It is. Okay.
Yes. Cool. So Rucker Moses is would be like the melding of my mind and Craig's mind together. It's a one being.
Yeah.
Craig and I have known each other for, I think it's been almost 20 years now.
Wow.
We met in college and at University of Georgia, and ended up in California at different times, and ended up creating a company together called Sunny Boy Entertainment.
Yeah.
And we often, you know, think of our boss is Sunny Boy. So we're kind of used to working under one moniker from our business life anyway. Creating Rucker Moses was like another way of us kind of keeping that same tradition going.
And what is Sunny Boy?
Well, Sunny Boy is a content production company.
Uh-huh.
And what I mean is, like, we work with, we have different stratas of how we work. Some of it, it's for marketing for feature films and television, and other bits of it, it's for, we've written for television shows, like Arl Stein's Haunting Hour and Spooksville. Craig and I were writers. We went under our real names that time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're like one, you got to pay two people. Two,
right,
get us in the Writers Guild.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely correct. So they would not take a one. You're Sunny. No, that's not going to fly. So we're definitely two people in that situation.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and so we do everything from visual effects and shooting with cameras, and now working VR and AR. We create original content in that space as well.
For virtual?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Wow, the virtual still blows my mind. What part of it do you do? Are you writing it, or you're actually doing the effects as well?
Yes, yeah, we do soup to nuts. We'll come up with the concepts and
wow,
write it, which is a kind of a mind thing in itself, and then kind of like we try and create a story from how people actually interact with the world, right? So a lot of times you'll see us kind of like thinking like, huh, if I were to walk through this door, what's the new story when I enter the next room? Because that's what it's like in VR, because you're no longer just looking at a plane or a proscenium. You're now looking at everything in the round. And so we do that, and then we build it in VR, or sometimes we'll scan stuff. We'll take some of our scanners and shoot or scan real locations, and then augment it with lights and stuff like that and put soundtracks in it.
Wow. Tries,
you know, we did well with some scaring some folks in the one for Warner Brothers for It. You know, that was fun.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so when you get to see this clown up close and personal, it's insane, right? Because It was said that, you know, that they were hiding the clown in it. In the trailers, they would never show it as much as possible because it kind of feel kind of silly. But when you're actually feeling like you're there face to face with this clown in a grate and then in the sewers and he's hunting you, oh, it's a different experience. And I would see people coming out of it just totally sweating and heart up, you know, racing. And for me, I'm like, after I've seen it a thousand times, I'm like, yeah, whatever. So it's a really cool thing to kind of like trick the mind and put yourself in a space.
And it is, it feels like it's a trick of the mind where, I wonder what else could be done in a virtual reality situation where mm-hmm. someone as a therapy type thing, you know, where you could like kind of come right face to face with your ghost or a clown.
I think there are some therapeutic applications that VR can really help people with.
Yeah,
you know, and especially because sometimes you don't really know what's about to happen, which I guess is sort of like life anyway. But but when it's programmed for you in an intense experience, it could be. Hopefully, it could be good for you.
I love how you have to think about what's behind the next door. There's almost a new scene. When I'm talking to my students, I'm always like, why do they leave the room and how do they leave the room and what do they go into? And
Absolutely. And
always keep them in the room. If it feels like the conflict is too high, do not mm-hmm. let them leave. They got to resolve it right there and escalate it.
Yeah. That's perfect. That is it. That's the way to really tell good stories. I think.
Yeah. Because we avoid conflict in life.
Right.
I don't want to get in a fight with a guy. I don't want to, I don't want to do all this stuff. But when we're writing our stories,
right.
that conflict's got to just be like, bam, bam, bam.
Right, right, right. Or if they do avoid it, you know, you're just adding on to that. Later on, you're going to have to deal with it. You're not dealing with that problem. It's going to come full face, you know, later down the road. So yeah, I like that.
Exactly. That's in stories. In real life, just push it down. Push it down.
Therapy.
Yeah. Just hold it in. Yeah, nothing bad will ever happen.
Nothing bad. Yeah. So what classes do you teach?
I teach right now. I'm teaching screenwriting.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's really fun because it reminds me of the joy of it. You know, where you get in the drudgery of it, and you're like, wait a second, why do I do this? And then you just like you see these like raw, fresh ideas and this excitement. Right. You're like, oh, that's right, I had
that's
that.
That's why you like it, right?
Yeah.
Craig and I ended up starting out as screenwriters. I mean, you know, we still are, but. but the novel thing was just kind of new to us. Writing prose was not like our original format, so we were definitely writing for screenplays first, and it was definitely a learning experience to start writing in prose.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's just that just realizing that there's actually so little dialogue sometimes in a book, in a novel, and there's so much more thoughts that you have to explain and describe everything, you know, whereas in dialogue, in a screenplay, you're just like, it's more like a blueprint, you know what I mean? It's like a blueprint for someone else to take and make it into a final creation. Whereas the book is it, that's it. That's all. That's the whole thing right there.
What else I always like about the book is that you're the one responsible for everything wrong and everything right with it. In a film or in a TV show, you'd be like, that editor doesn't know what he's doing. Oh, that actor, that was a bad casting.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, my love for movies goes way back to, you know, I'm an army kid. So I lived in Europe growing up. During the, I guess around roughly around the 80s. So my dad was in the army, and so we traveled a lot. And going to the local video store, looking at all the covers, and then smelling the cardboard, and then picking something based off of that. It was no Blockbuster, you know, and that movie time together in Europe, because there's very few English speaking channels to watch stuff, was like a strong introduction to like feature films and storytelling, you know. So I was very, very much engrossed in the moving picture.
I bet. Yeah, the few times I was in Europe, I remember finding English films to go to the theater. Mm-hmm. And during the movie, I would totally forget that I was in Paris or, you know, the Czech Republic.
Right.
You walk back outside and you're like, oh, wait a second, I'm a foreigner.
Yeah. Yeah. Seeing movies in different countries is really interesting in a theater.
Yeah. Where did you spend most of the time when you were in Europe? Did you have like a place where you were kind of hunkered down for a little bit?
Well, when I was in my formative years, it was probably like Wiesbaden in West Germany. And then they were also from Hamburg when I was younger. But Wiesbaden was the main place. And then we would travel around, you know, kind of check things out. And I left East Berlin the day before the wall fell.
Wow.
And so it was an adventure.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, do you speak any German?
Nein.
You sound fluid to me. That's all I needed to hear.
Yeah.
So you were kind of like with the other kids in on the base type.
Yes, thing. Exactly. I mean, and then occasionally we would interact with other, you know, German kids and like the swim bods and the playgrounds and stuff like that. It's always fun to do that. But for the most part, we were with the other military kids too.
So when you get back to the United States, did you get to go to like a high school or something in Atlanta? And did you get to come back in and go, all right, now I'm in American high school?
Well, actually it was like total, I think I've been to about 15 schools in total.
Wow.
Yeah. And then that's including college, but then when I got back, I was in middle school. So we were in Maryland. And it was kind of tough at first because A, middle school is just tough, but B, it was, there was like a whole use of slang and language that I was very not accustomed to from being in, you know, in Europe for a while. And so I just kind of like had to learn not just English, but just like a colloquial, you know, sayings and like what is slang. I there were so many things that was just foreign to me in my own country. And then we moved from Maryland a few years later to down to Atlanta. And that was an adjustment. I went to three different high schools there. So it was a lot of change, but it's really cool. And it just makes you kind of like make friends pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's a good way to go with it. Because the other way is the lone guy in the corner. And then, do you remember like some of the slang where you're just like, what are you talking about? Do you remember any?
Well, like I think it was something like dissing somebody. I didn't know what that was. Or, oh man, you joned on. Oh, he's joning on me. I'm like, What's that mean? I was like, is this Joan Rivers? What are we talking about?
I don't even know that one. I know this, but what's joning? What's joning?
Well, it's sort of the same thing.
Okay.
It's sort of the same thing. It's like, in fact, it's so old, I don't even know if I remember exactly what it means anymore.
Yeah.
But it was, there were just like really weird kind of like weird slang that would come up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when you're that age, you just pretend like you know what they're talking about. You're like,
absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure. And you have your one friend, you're like, what's going on?
Right. How does it hang at me? It sounds really intimate, but I'm not sure.
Radical was off, was, you know, those were like, I got those, you know, that was like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles stuff. So got that stuff.
And then, When did you get the writing bug? Were you young, really young, and said, you know what, I'm really vibing this, or vibing means enjoying.
Yeah, I got you. I got you there. When I was in high school, I think there was an opportunity where we had to tell stories in a classroom, and this one guy, I don't remember his name, but he wrote something that was, you know, pretty scary. And I was like, I could write better than that. And so I gave a crack at it. And I just kind of wrote another scarier story just to see how the class, you know, reacted to it. And I thought that was pretty cool. But that's about as far as it went right there for a while. And then my dad, who was pretty influential in my life, kind of has a saying, like, if it's important, write it down, right? If it means something, put it on paper. That was his saying. So, and I got a lot of lectures from my dad, which is really cool, because, I mean, I live a lot by some of those things. And so he would say that kind of stuff. So when Craig and I ended up trying to make videos together, we basically, the best way to communicate the idea was to write it on, put it down on paper. And I'll backtrack. There was one professor in school that really, really made me catch the bug, which was Matt Kosciuszko. I kind of got away with writing like a 2-page paper when I was supposed to write a 5-pager, but it was, he thought the accuracy of the expression of which I did was very well, that he just said I should never write anything less than what was told again, but he really enjoyed the paper. And something about, again, having that kind of reaction from the audience, and it's sort of where I guess I'm coming from, where it's like, I realized that that's the thing that drives me, is like saying like, oh, if I write this and I convey a thought, do you get what I'm saying? Right. So it's unlike where someone's speaking in slang and I don't understand what they're saying, I want to make sure you definitely understand what I'm saying. And so even between my best friend, Craig, and I, we still needed to speak to each other in such a way, was in order to make something, we had to write it down and write a screenplay. And so from there, it was just more about communication. It was just more about like conveying the idea so that we can be on the same page, because I had a wife and I was working, and then we would meet in the afternoons at a hotel lobby down in downtown LA and just kind of write these screenplays together. But so we only had like a couple hours to just kind of get these ideas out. So it was like, all right, well, let's be very precise about it, trade papers, and then we'll go and try and make this video, right? Which is a ninja epic, you know, or thing or something like that. And then we made this ghost story for that we call Ghost Town. And we spent our own money and we shot it. And it was awesome, and it opened up a lot of doors for us. So that just kind of kept snowballing into communicating more and more and more, and kind of create more and more videos.
Wow. So when you're working on the first one, did you have to go out there and like cast it and do like pretty much everything top to bottom?
Yes. That's kind of our MO, actually.
Yeah.
That's the MO of Sunny Boy for sure, from top to bottom.
And I'm sure there was like no budget for that first one.
There was no budget, but we had just kind of like successfully produced another project. And, you know, when you're young, you don't think about saving money. We're like, well, let's just use our own money. And we're like, all right. It's not a good way to start a company.
I also love the naive part of it when we're young and we're just like, yeah. Oh my God, I got money to burn. Let's burn it. Let's burn it on something that's so impractical, but that we love. Right. And then it wouldn't have gotten made if you were too practical, because you might be in a completely different position. You know?
You're exactly correct. I mean, it was the most impractical thing we could have done. Like, I really should have been like investing in the company in other ways.
Yeah.
But, this is why we would meet up and kind of like wanted to follow in the footsteps of, like, you know, all the greats trying to make some cool shows that would be on the air. And so it was a cool show, a cool pilot. Uh-huh. And then met with distributors and I realized like, oh, they don't want to put more money into it. They want to know if I have 10 of these so they can just put a library out. And so even though it opened up our writing career with the other studios, it didn't like pan out as a good business investment.
Right. But at the same time, you got to, that's when you got to know from top to bottom what it takes to go from writing to on set to post-production. It probably gives you a lot of value knowing everything across the board.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, like I said, that's how we train every other person who comes into the company as well. It's like, listen, you're going to wear a lot of hats here. Yeah. You're going to do a lot of things. And if the more you can communicate, the better off you're going to do here, you know? So
right. How do you feel about doing craft services for 3 weeks?
Well, you know, there's an art to that too. You know,
there's
an art to that. And if craft services is terrible, people are not going to be happy, and no one's communicating at that point.
No, if everyone has gas on the set, you know, on the whole afternoon.
Yeah, there's that too. Yeah. So when we got to, you know, having a good career, trying to make stuff, we're still trying to make stuff.
Is that the fun of it? Like continuing to try to make stuff, just going,
okay, absolutely.
We have zero. What are we doing with zero and making it something?
That's it. That's where all the jazz is, you know, for us. That's it. That's what we even like about this book, is like saying, okay, because we wrote it as a TV show first.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So it was Amazon picked it up as a script first, and then it just never went to pilot, they never shot the pilot. So, you know, it kind of sat around for a while, and that all that just kind of expired. And I don't think Amazon's doing kids stuff anymore. And then our book agent, Jane Starts, said, like, you know, you could probably get this out again if you turn it into a novel. You're like, okay, sure. Wow, that was an uphill battle. It took almost 2 years. Even having a blueprint of a screenplay, it took us almost another good 2 years of trying to get that bad boy into a novel form. And then, after talking to Miss Stacy, our editor at Penguin Random House, you know, they liked what we did, but they wanted someone a little stronger in the prose world to kind of join us. And we're like, all right, well, who do you suggest? So Stacy introduced us to a number of people, and we've gravitated to Theo Ganji's writing. He took our work and he changed it and put it in a first person perspective.
Oh, wow.
Of Kingston. And he's from New York too. So the New York, all the flavors and, you know, colloquial sayings and slang came out, so that we could understand what a New York kid from Brooklyn would actually sound like. And it just kind of brought a life to the character. And then we all realized, like, that's the guy. So we teamed up with Theo and started crafting Kingston as it is today. And it really educated us on how to write more in a different way, but also like to collaborate with another person that was stepping into a relationship that Craig and I already had for a long period of time. It was a little bit scary, but it actually worked out quite well. Theo and Craig and I feel like we're long lost brothers. And we kind of like, we talk about the same things. We watch the same things growing up. We do similar things. I've only met Theo. No, I actually haven't met Theo in the flesh at all.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Not once.
It's so intriguing, this whole world where it's just like we can pass stories back and forth to each other and really work on an intimate level.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, oh, yeah. It's like when I've had that situation and I do finally meet the person, it doesn't feel like I'm meeting them for the first time. It's just like, oh, you're just a brother. Okay, what's it? Yeah.
Right.
Good to see you. You're wrong about this, but thanks about that, you know.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. We definitely fought about some things. We definitely had our differences at certain points, but it was all, we really chucked a lot of our egos to the door and just said, look, it's what is good for the characters? Like, how are they actually going to overcome this scenario or go through this? Or how are we going to describe this other world called the realm in our book? You know, sometimes you can paint yourself into a corner, you know, and then you have to realize, like, oh, I've kind of like sold this whole concept off of this thing. Now I got to really make it a reality, you know.
And that's in the part of the con. I mean, that's the joy of conflict when you're working with other creative people. Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. we're having this conflict to serve the story.
Right.
We need this. Okay. We're painted into a corner. This is right. how I think of it. Tell me if right. I'm completely wrong. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. But you're just like, you get that vibration where it's just like, no, you're wrong. No, you're right. No, you know, not in those words because for you sure. want to, but you just like, it leads to things.
Right. And that's the fun part, right? When it leads to things, you know, it's like, well, I mean, that's actually kind of what happened to us. It was cool. You know, our first draft was cool, but it was just lacking in something, right? And then one day Craig goes to the Afrofuturism event in downtown LA, which you can find something in LA. Whatever you're looking for. But he was checks us out. And one of his favorite musicians, Sun Ra. He's found out that his name is, he was named after Black Herman. Apparently one of the world's greatest Black magicians. And so we're like, who's that? Never heard of him. You know, we talked about Houdini and all these other magicians in our book, but and, you know, and our cast, main cast is just primarily black cast. We're like, but, you know, where are the other elders that our black cast members can look up to, right? Well, all of a sudden, we just kind of like found a whole nother section of history of magic that we were totally unaware of and started doing a lot more research. And that's when we start to, I would say this was the final piece that really made the story and the journey and what Kingston and his group of friends go on as something really, really special, because I discovered something that I really debated a good bit about, right? Mm-hmm. Do Black people like magic?
Yeah.
It was really a question for me, you know, I mean, it was a question for me because, you know, there have been times where, again, being a Southern, or partially my family's just from the South, being a Southerner, it's like, you know, things that, like, if there's any superstitions, they're real to us, you know what I mean? It's like, so it's like when you see somebody doing some magic, it's like, oh, I don't know if I want to mess with these guys, right? Because it's got a spiritual kind of element to it. But to not know that there are magicians, practicing magicians who practice illusions and practice sleight of hand, we were unaware of this. And so once we discovered this, we realized like, oh, wow, let's put these guys in our book, put these guys as characters they will actually encounter in our book, because they do some world traveling and time bending kind of stuff. And so it really kind of, in our opinion, elevates what our characters go through.
That's really cool. Yeah. With the dark arts where it actually is like, oh, we are going to other planes. We are speaking to dead people. There's a part of me where I'm like, you might be doing that. And I don't know if I open that door, weird things going to be happening to me. I don't know if you get the same thing, but it's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a visceral level for sure. Mm-hmm. Right. But the way we explain it is more on one of my favorite authors is Arthur C. Clarke, which was anything advanced enough, any science advanced enough will appear to be magic to anyone lesser than that, right?
Huh. Yeah.
So we kind of approach it that way. That is it's not dark arts. It's
right.
It's just really advanced science and it feels like magic. Because it's kind of pushing the boundaries of what we understand in physics and what we understand in how the world and energy works.
Yeah.
So we really take it there. So Craig and I have, again, that's why Sunny Boy is named SUNNY, right? Because we love science and space. And so we infuse that kind of energy even into our stories still yet. So we're always talking about like, well, I didn't want any spells. I didn't want any wands in this book at all. So it's like, well, where do you get the fantasy element? Well, let's talk about advanced science. Let's talk about theoretical physics and stuff like that and kind of bring that into the mix.
And then it's even cooler because it's not the wand seems like just a cheap device, but when you go into it with like, oh no, really thought out, this might be able to happen in a parallel way, and if you look at the weird angle that way, but we're always looking this way.
Absolutely, right. And so it's taking like Pepper's Ghost and expanding on it and say, well, if these crystals were larger, what would a crystal be able to do? What kind of energy vibrates off of that? Who could live off of that kind of energy, right? So we kind of take it to that level in order to kind of create our magic, you know? So that was what made it a lot of fun. So that was, like you said, it leads to things, right? So all this exploration of writing together led to a richer story for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like there is energy in things. Mm-hmm. This is something kind of new to me over the last decade. Okay. Like even like when you meet someone in person or whatever, there's an energy of attraction repelling going on where, it seems like physical energy actually happening, even if we're just talking to someone.
I totally agree with you. Sometimes you meet people and you just kind of know within a few minutes, like, are we going to be cool? Right. Yeah, we're going to be cool because we're vibing. Reviving! There's the word.
Right.
Right? But vibration, like the whole world, everything around us is the vibration anyway. So it's like all that they tell you, like you're basically a bunch of molecules and atoms held together by electromagnetic field that's vibrating on a certain frequency. So that not just you, the chair, the table, the air, everything. So it's like, and you know, vibrations are what are also part of what birds and animals migrate, you know? So it's like, who says we're not doing the same thing? We just don't really take the time to acknowledge it.
Oh, interesting. I like that, because we might be doing things that are like nature, and we're unknowingly doing things, but we're essentially migrating south for the winter.
essentially, right? Right. We're saying like, are you part of my flock? I don't know. Like, well, we had to meet first, right?
Right.
And feel the energy. But what's also funky is like, as a human species, we can do this through this screen. We can you can meet people not even physically anymore. So it's like, so now I'm starting to learn about a whole nother thing called just like the science of consciousness, right? Uh-huh. Right. It's like saying like, okay, well, that's cool. Like birds and all them, they're all together in a pride or a flock or something like that. But what about humans meeting just electronically and communicating? And when we make a recording and you still connect with the character, even if they're not real, what is that? What is that makes us connect to each other? It's like, you know, this idea of like conscious, that we're all part of one consciousness, but we're localized in our own flesh and blood bodies, but we're all being still connected on a vibratory level.
And at the same time, we could be blocking things that are open to us. I went too hippie there.
No, I mean, you know, trust me, when we're writing our stuff, man, we go all the way there, right? Uh-huh. It's like, if it works for what we're talking about, sure. But I think that's what's kind of cool about this craft, is being able to be open to ideas. I don't have to discount them, right? I can hear it and listen to it and weigh it. And if it works for me right then and there, sure. If it doesn't, maybe I'll come back to it later, you know?
But I just feel like bad ideas actually turn into something down the road, and we needed the bad idea. Or I need that really crappy first draft. Even if I think it was crappy and it was the stupidest thing I could have ever done, that was important to get to the next thing.
Right. So how many revisions do you go through?
2,000. It depends. I mean, sometimes it'll blow my mind where a first draft will be close.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'll be like, what? Are you kidding? Wow. And it doesn't happen all the time, but you know, a lot of it's tinkering, and I'm learning that, you know, I feel like I might be working on three different things, and then I realize, oh wait, they're all one. Got to kill that darling. Got to kill that darling. Wow. Got to kill that darling. Bring it in.
Wow. Does it mess with you a little bit? Like this? Like
every day.
Oh, okay. So I might need to acknowledge that myself, you know, that it's all one thing. Yeah.
It's not fun. Like sometimes people are like, oh my God, it must be so fun to like write. And it's like, part of it's like, you know, not fun and therapeutic, but I just love it. Mm. It's almost going to war with, you know, like even when you're on a production on a film set, I always feel like you're at war. You're against time, always. You're against money, and you have to, this vision has to happen. And it just, and that's why, like when you're on, even on film or TV, you're just like, you're forming these, it's like intense intimacy with all these people for a while. And then after it's done, you're like, all right, I just got to get away from you. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I personally like to be efficient too. You know, like when it comes down to, like I said, being on a set, it's like war. It's just like, but you know, sometimes you realize like there's a cadence to everything in life, right? There's a cadence to how I approach a set. It's like, so I want to tackle the hard shots first, because I'm going to spend more time on them, right? And then I've had one time where my AD was like, you guys aren't going to finish your day. You're not going to finish. And I was like, no, we're going to finish. And he's like, why? And I was like, because what he didn't realize, I already tackled the hard stuff. After that, it was all like, now my actors were in the zone. They understood who the characters were. They already lived through that. So did I. And we were able to just like knock out everything else and just like triple our efficiency, and we were done and made it right on the nick of time. Cause I personally, dude, I am like, again, the military kid in me is tries to be very efficient.
I bet. So tackling the hard stuff first, that's an interesting way to go about it. Cause it doesn't ease people into it. It's like, we're going in full steam ahead here. Hey, camera department, have fun with this problem. Hey, lighting, have fun with this problem. Hey, actors, have fun with this problem.
Right. Well, then you're all in the war together, right?
Yeah.
You've all kind of gone to battle together. And the rest is like, all right, now we got to fill the gaps. Let's fill these gaps in.
Yeah. Now we just need you to walk in a dress in the sunset. That's amongst the flowers.
Right.
Cut, print, next.
Right. Next, let's move on. Right. And, you know, so what's a trip to me is how people are still doing production during this tough time. It's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, but we still need it, right? We need this. We need entertainment still yet. Even more so maybe now than ever.
Even more. Yeah. It's, you know, what a beautiful time for mediocre TV shows and film where it was like done, and then people were just like, yeah, this is never going to be anywhere. COVID hits and they're like, oh, this is going to be great. Right. Fill the gap.
Yeah. There's so much to watch and consume these days.
Yeah.
It's just insane.
Yeah. What got you excited recently? As we sit and just, the, you know, watching Netflix is the new punk rock show. It's the new dinner date.
right. As far as like television is concerned, Cobra Kai.
I've watched the first couple episodes of the first.
Yeah.
I really like it so far.
Yeah. I thought they were just clever in how they could do all these callbacks to something older and give it a twist and make it new again, you know? Yeah. And I just thought that was really smart and efficient and to catch you off guard and play with your nostalgia and make you just really want to stick around. So my wife and I really like watching that. But I gotta be honest, I've been writing and just being in VR quite a bit.
Yeah. When you write VR, I mean, it's because that's like completely different than a screenplay, right? There's a lot more. Is it, or am I wrong? Are you just like, this is where we need to get to now? Here are the VR notes to make it happen.
It's interesting. again, you always got to think about what's the user experience, right? How do they traverse through this landscape? And what is the landscape? How does the landscape itself tell a story? So the story is imbued in the landscape, right? And then I can make things happen. And now that I'm working in this other program, like AllSpace VR, it's a social platform. So it's not VR by yourself anymore. It's VR with maybe 50 people, right? And so how do you create a story that they all can experience and as opposed to being a giant chat room, you know? Right. So there's challenges, there's new challenges that I like to take on in that world. And so again, it has to literally be built into the environment itself.
So it's almost like come up with the environment first, come up with the walls and the doors and the, is that the first thing where you just like, we get the environment, then we figure out what's inside of it? Or,
well, let's just see. Yeah. I mean, you do have to draft it up. I not only that, you it's probably good. It's usually very good to hand draw some stuff too. Oh, yeah. So, you know, you draft up the, you kind of sketch things. And so it's like there's a mechanic. That's the other thing. You have to think about physical mechanics. What does this platform offer? If I walk and rock off a cliff, do I just drop, or can another plane below catch me? And what does that do for me as a user experiencing that, right? So let's say I want someone to feel like they've kind of done like an easy level, right? Which is a part of a story, game level, easy level. But now I want them to kind of progress even further. So I've coaxed them to say, oh, wow, you know, I have little characters and you've really got to move on and help my grandmother over here. And then it's like you go over there and there's a hidden drop. You fall onto the next platform and it's another level. So the falling itself makes you, what do I want that to be? Do you fall through a tube that's showing you your life passing you by? Or do you go through a tube of colors to say, hey, you're getting a power up and I feel like I'm now in an anime magical transition and I'm becoming Voltron. And now when I land, I'm in another suit. So there's all kinds of ways of kind of telling the story through the mechanics of the world itself.
Wow.
You know, so, it happens so fast. It happens so fast because there's only the now.
Yeah.
It's only the now. And it's still, and even that exists in VR.
Huh.
And the more you think about it, and the more you play towards that, the better the story, right?
Yeah. I put on VR goggles once. A friend of mine, Devin, he works in it, and he's like, here, try these on. This was a few years ago. Yeah. And I was in a city.
Yeah.
And I was on a tall skyscraper. And I have a fear of heights. I hate it. Yeah, and I just sit there going, I was like this. I'm not moving anywhere,
right?
And it was so real, and I was just like, wow, this is cool. I know I'm not here, but it feels like I'm here, and it's freaking me out.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, again, it's all storytelling, man. It's all storytelling. Like, you could say that, but now once you put a cat at the other end of that tightrope,
yeah,
right. So the story becomes about you. Do you have the courage to go get this cat and save
no,
the cat?
No.
Or someone might overcome that. Someone might overcome their fear and go get that cat.
I love cats. I'm a cat guy, but no, that cat can die like the scum it is for being that high. You're not going out there.
That's your fault.
The cat made some bad decisions in its life and they need to take responsibility.
I hear you. There you go. Life decisions. Right?
Yeah. But in real life, I'm sure if it was my cat and I had it for 10 years, I would catapulting over it.
Right.
But there's the beauty in that too, because we do get courage with, I guess, with things outside of us that we care about. There's a courage that we could muster up that we wouldn't muster up just for ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's just the same with like writing reading a novel or a book or watching a scary movie. You know, it's just like, do you have the courage to watch a scary scene and, you know, hang out with your family, or for whatever reason they want to watch a scary movie?
Right, right.
So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think we as humans are storytelling creatures who are addicted to stories.
I think it continues to help us make sense of the chaos of what a human being is.
Wow. Yeah.
Are you vibing me?
Yeah, man. Yeah, we're vibing.
I love you. Hold up your scotch. Yeah, that, what was that again? Yeah.
Oh, Glenlivet.
Glenlivet?
Yeah.
What is that, the 12 year?
Caribbean Reserve, apparently.
Whoa.
Yeah.
High end stuff. And like, where'd you get the curly straw?
I do have a few of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta have a sense of humor in life, right?
No, exactly. No, it's interesting how I continue to be fascinated by it. I grew up in a weird religion. I grew up a Jehovah's Witness. So I had this weird angle on the Bible.
Okay.
But then I've come to realize, oh no, we need these stories. We need these. Mm-hmm. Everything's kind of important, and we also are continuing to create our mythologies, even if it isn't, right. Even if we're doing VR or I'm reading your book, we get to like embrace these mythologies, and it feeds us. It's so cool.
It feeds us on a soul level, right?
Yeah.
It helps guide us. Oh, sorry, one second.
Yeah. Are the kids coming?
Yeah. Well. Hey, Harold, can you close the door, please?
How old are your kids?
My son, whose also name is Harold, will be 6 years old in a couple days. And my daughter is 10.
Yeah. Do they test your VR too? Do you go, all right, you guys, yeah, we're going in?
Yeah, they check it out. They go in and, not mine. The ones I've made are usually lately had been scary stories.
So, oh, okay.
They don't really dig that stuff. But we play Beat Saber and, you know, these other kind of like physical activity games. They do enjoy it. What I find is that kids today, or at least mine, can gravitate to this stuff so much quicker than I ever did or what other adults do. They kind of just get it. They know. Yeah. Oh, this is how this works. I'm like, wow. You know, and it's, so I'm always like, sometimes say, hey, try this out.
Yeah.
My daughter, she's just kind of a natural at programming, and she's a natural at just kind of like, she's a great reader. She's good at math. I'm just like, what is going on? You know what I mean? And I put her in a VR and she just took to it like a fish in water. And it's just like, wow. I just was really unsure of how that happened, because it wasn't like we allowed her to be on the tablet or anything for till she was much older. Or she's only 10. But you know, was older. So she was older, you know. So it was just kinda weird to see how the youth today can really just attach to things so fast.
And it's just part of normalcy. It's just like, oh yeah, oh this is life, okay, this is life too, I'm fine, and it's just immediately adaptable.
Yeah. So she my daughter read my book, our book, Kingston Images.
Hold up, what, so did she read it before it was published or after?
Before.
Okay. She was one of the beta readers.
She's one of the beta readers. Uh-huh. Right.
Okay.
And I was a little curious, because my kids don't typically like anything that gets suspenseful, right? And there's a few suspenseful moments in this book, right? So I was wondering how she's going to handle it, but she read it like in a flash, and I was really surprised. But she comes in and just telling me, like, with this huge smile, she was just like extremely happy. And my daughter is not one to express a lot of emotion. You know what I mean? I mean she does, but she doesn't like. She's not gonna. Just to give you like a couple words, you know. Yeah, it was cool. Yeah. But she comes in, she's like, that was really good. And I'm like, really? What's going on? And she's like, well, I said, what did you like? She says, the ending was amazing. And we do a big build for the ending. But she was, for her to be that excited about it is when I knew, like, okay, because until then, you know, you always doubt what you've made, you know what I mean? But when my daughter kind of said it was that, and with excitement, actual enthusiasm, that it was good, that's when I was like, okay, because I don't care what anybody else tells you, but there's just always that one person that you really use as a barometer, and now it's her for me. It was her, because again, she's not going to give me a lot anyways. Yeah. So for her to like it, and it was only mainly because she thought that it was somewhat of a happy ending.
Huh.
That's what I'll say.
That's what's beautiful about kids that age is they know story and they don't have a filter.
Yeah.
Be like, you know what? That's good. No, that sucks. No, that's good. There's
kind right.
of beauty to that, you know?
That's right. Wow. Huh. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she definitely doesn't have much of a filter.
Yeah. No, she'd be good to like pitch other ideas on, like, you know, it's just like, all right, me and Craig are working on this. Set her down. Me and Craig are working on this.
Right.
Picture the scene.
She'll be very annoyed with her father at that point.
We're doing another pitch meeting, kid.
Right. Yeah. Well, you get your green light wherever you can, right?
Exactly. It's abuse in Hollywood for kids right now, because they're like, does your father pitch stories to you in school? You know, not like
I love it. I love it. That should be a great skit.
Oh my dad pitches stories about rom-coms. You know, the kids know all the lingo.
right. Oh, that's in the beltway. Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. What kind of screenplays do you write?
I try to write about stuff about my life, and it's like comedy and tragedy. Sometimes I'm just like, why am I not a why don't I write detective stories? I need to write more detective stories. I'm actually reading a lot more crime and more detective stories.
Okay.
So I'm trying to fill that instead of like all these personal things. Let's get the personal things out of the way.
Sure.
Let's get into reading crime stories, detective, whodunit. Gotcha. Who done it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the mystery concept is probably one of the most alluring story models out there.
Yeah.
It's why The Matrix 1 works better than all the other Matrixes.
Right. Well,
right? Because it's like, everyone's like, oh, I said, well, Matrix 1 is a mystery.
Yeah.
The other one escalates to action.
Right. We there is no mystery left.
There is no mystery left.
Now we know, like, the world, yeah.
Right. So now it's like, you know he's the one. What else is he going to do? Right. Exactly. And so if you're not into that storytelling, then it's not for you after that.
It wasn't the Matrix. It was so fantastic. I remember the previews. They would just say, "What is the Matrix?
What is the Matrix?"
They didn't even like clue you in too much.
Right.
It's like, what is the Matrix?
Right. Similaris simulacra.
Yeah. The way they brought you in. It's continuing to ask questions of your reader or your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, they'll have more questions. Oh my God, I got to know why. I got to know what. And then we get a, you know, beautiful actor like Keanu Reeves taking us on the journey.
Right.
That was the best casting ever.
It truly was. Truly. I can't even imagine what they're going to do for number four. Like, where do you go after that?
Oh, there's another one. That's right. They're shooting it, aren't they?
Yeah, they're shooting it.
Where do you go? You know what movie I just watched, and I got to interview the writer of it, was the Bill and Ted's the latest one. The latest
oh yeah, one Face of Music.
Ted. Yeah, did you watch that?
Yes.
Yeah, I loved that he didn't sit there and pretend like these guys were young.
Right.
Like these guys are middle aged men.
Yes.
They're having a midlife crisis and they got kids. And I'm just like, that's real. That's real.
Yeah.
That brought me into that movie more than the sequels, more than the other sequels that they did.
So. I agree. Totally agree. Yeah. Take it for what it is, and, you know, and write it, make it real as possible.
Yeah, and just yeah. and it's great that those actors were on board with it, because you know how actors get. They're like, oh, I don't want to show my age. You know, it's just like, I know I'm 55, but I play 30. Right, like, right. Now you know.
Yeah. Although I don't know. I think Tom Cruise is eternally 30.
But he took the secret sauce at the Scientology building. So that's okay. Yeah. There's only three Scientologists that can get the secret sauce. I don't know who the other two are, but I know one's Tom Cruise.
Gotcha. Yeah. He definitely has the secret sauce for sure.
The thing, I'm not a fan of Scientology, but I am a fan of Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Huge man.
Yeah, I don't think I would ever like him in person. Uh-huh. I don't think I'd even want him near me, but yeah. I will go watch every movie he's in, because he is just fantastic. He's fantastic on the screen.
He's fantastic, yes.
Mission Impossible, I'm there opening day every single time.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of, again, I'm 80s kid, so.
Yeah,
I grew up watching Tom Cruise.
Right, Top Gun.
Yeah, well, for sure. You know. Yeah. And I'm so like, that was the big downer for me. I mean, you know, like one of the, from the box office pandemic, you know, moving the dates around, was Top Gun got moved.
Right.
Like, oh, I was so ready to see it. The trailer looked amazing.
I know.
It's just like.
I fly my own planes now. Yeah, I do my own stunts now.
I know. I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, he's actually flying that plane.
Yeah. Like those helicopters in Mission Impossible. They're like, let's do these on the last day in case you die.
Right. Well, yeah. Oh, now that's interesting. A VR guy, put a VR 360 camera. There's a special feature of him flying that helicopter by himself. And
oh, wow.
So that's the beautiful thing about 360 or VR, is that it can tell the truth. You know,
interesting. Yeah,
you know, like you see that there's no one else in there. He's just doing it himself.
Oh, and wow!
And that was amazing. I thought that was the best use. That was one of the really good uses of 360 footage.
Yeah, because then we could see that it's not about the editing and the cuts. This guy's really doing it, really in there.
Yeah,
but he did the. So your VR guy did the.
Not mine. Someone else. Oh. I mean, but I just saw someone else. It's all featurette, behind the scenes featurette, that was in 360, a VR 360, and they showed that, and I thought that was like a really good use of that technology to show the truth of what someone at his caliber has like trained himself to do.
Yeah, I'm gonna go jump off a building and twist my ankle. Okay, we'll do it one well, let's do it one more time.
Yeah.
He's not human. He probably is. Scientology is probably right. They're probably right because of him. If you do Scientology exactly right, you're Tom Cruise.
Well, sign me up.
I think I'll go in with you. Let's go get clear, my friend.
Well, no, I think I'll stand over here and keep doing this. I'll keep doing that. Jumping off a building, not my cup of tea.
Oh, I know. Yeah, same here. Harold, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Tony. I really appreciate it.
And that's it. That was
all right, man. This is awesome.
Harold Hayes Jr. on Drinks with Tony, one half of the writing team of Rucker Moses. Check out their new book, Kingston and the Magicians Lost and Found. And hey, do you want a bonus episode this week? Well, I got you covered. Check out episode 125 with my 92-year-old debut author. Yes, she's 92 and she published her first book. Her name is Sue Beyer, and she's on the next episode of Drinks with Tony. Thanks for listening to Drinks with Tony. You are on your radio dial at 101.9 FM KPCR LP Santa Cruz.